Good evening. So having taken a week's break for Matan Torah, we return to receive a little bit more and we turn our attention to Parshas Baalosecha, which is packed with so many things. Major Parshas, mitzvos, and we begin where better than the beginning, and that is the mitzvah of menorah. Vaydaber Hashem Moshe Lemor, Perek Ches, Pasuk Aleph, and then Beis. Daber El Aharon V'Amar Toilav, speak to Aaron, and say to him, Behalos Dechayas Haneros, when you raise the lights, Al Milpani HaMenorah, Ye'iru Shivas Haneros, all seven shall illuminate. This is the mitzvah of Hadlokas Haner. This is not the first time that it's been mentioned in the Torah. It's actually the third, as we often mention. As we begin, it's already in Parshas Tetzaveh. We have the concept of Hadlokas Haneros at the very beginning, in the end of Parshas Emor, and this is the third and final mention of the mitzvah of menorah. Rashi, as he sometimes does, and perhaps the aforementioned is one of the reasons, gets involved in the idea of Smichus Parshios, the juxtaposition of certain sections in the Torah. Of course, the default is that not everything can be said at once, and things will be said one after the other. But sometimes there's something about the situation that causes Rashi to comment as to why one thing follows on from the other. Again, as we said, maybe because the mitzvah of menorah has already been stated twice, but it comes back again. Says Rashi, and what came before the beginning of Baalosecha? Well, the end of Parshas Noso. And what's at the end of Noso is the Chanukas HaMishkan, the korbanos that were brought by the Nesiim. Rashi says, Lama nismecha Parshas HaMenorah leParshas HaNesiim. What's the menorah in the beginning of our Parsha got to do with the Nesiim at the end of last week's Parsha? And Rashi explains, well-known words of Rashi, from the Medrash. Lefisha kasheroa Aaron Chanukas HaNesiim. When Aaron sees the inauguration, these 12 days of the Nesiim, each day another one is bringing korbanos. Chol sha'av azdato. He had chalishas hadas. He became despondent. Shelo haya imayim b'chanukah. He was not involved in that process. Lohu v'lo shivto. Not him, not his tribe. He was somehow excluded. Amar la Kodesh Baruch Hu, Hashem says to Aaron, Chayecha, by your life, Shelcha gedola mishelahem. Your portion will be greater than theirs. Shata madlik umeitiv es haneros. You will be lighting the menorah. This was the nechama, the consolation for Aaron. Not only consolation, it's greater than theirs. And thus, we lead in from the Chanukas Nesiim of last week's Parsha, to the menorah mentioned with reference to Aaron, which is greater than what the other Nesiim did. And Rashi seems to imply that the consolation for Aaron was the avoda of lighting the menorah in the Beis HaMikdash. Rashi says that he is madlik umeitiv es haneros, which are the two parts of the avoda in the Beis HaMikdash. Madlik, to light at night, Meitiv, to prepare the wicks already the following morning. Rashi certainly seems to, did not say otherwise, and really seems to be imply that we're talking about Aaron's avoda of lighting the menorah, the daily avoda. And this draws a number of questions from the Ramban. Firstly, says Ramban, what does Hashem mean to say to Aaron? You will have this ongoing mitzvah called Hadlokas Haner. Ongoing mitzvahs for Aaron in the Beis HaMikdash, or in the Mishkan, are many. Menorah is one of them. But in the same way that every day Aaron would light the menorah, it's equally true that every day Aaron would or could bring the Keteres. And he has a special korban that's only for the Kohen Gadol, also on a daily basis. And all the general korbanos that are brought, daily korbanos. And once a year there's an avodah that only Aaron can do. In the Kodesh HaKadoshim. So the menorah, how, by virtue of what is the menorah singled out? As this is the comfort for Aaron that you will have this mitzvah on an ongoing basis. Yeah, he has many mitzvahs on an ongoing basis. And by the same token, or another expression of the same question, Aaron is performing all of these avodos while the Nesi'im are bringing their korbanos. The Nesi'im, the 12 Nesi'im, brought their special korbanos on the first 12 operational days of the Mishkan. If the Mishkan is operational, that means every single avoda is already up and running, which means on day one, when Nachshon ben Aminadav brought his korbanos, he would have met Aaron in the Mishkan, bringing his korbanos, including lighting the menorah. Which means, how is this a consolation? You were excluded from that, but this will be yours. It's already Aaron's. All of these days. Moreover, says Ramban, the only way seemingly to explain how Aaron still felt excluded, even though he's performing the avoda literally shoulder to shoulder with the Nesi'im, or side by side. Why does he feel excluded? Because Aaron's avoda are regular avodas, shall we say, day-to-day avodas, part of the established avodas. But the Nesi'im were inaugurating. They were launching the Beis HaMikdash with the Mishkan, with their special korbanos. And Aaron felt excluded from that. Well, if that's the case, says Ramban, well, how is the menorah any consolation for him? The menorah is an established daily avoda. So either way you look at it, it's either a consolation, even though it's a regular avoda, in which case he already has it and he's been doing it. And if it's not a consolation because it's not an inauguration, well, then it's not a consolation to receive it afterwards. It's still a regular avoda. All of these are very fundamental questions raised by the Ramban, and they lead the Ramban to offer a different interpretation of the Medrash. Again, the words of the Medrash are there. He's parting ways with Rashi in terms of how to understand it. The Medrash says, Aaron felt despondent and Hashem consoled him with the lighting of the menorah. Which lighting of the menorah? We would have understood it's Aaron's regular lighting of the menorah. Says Ramban, no. I believe that if Aaron felt excluded because he was not involved in an inauguration of the Mishkan, not him nor his tribe, then what is his consolation? That it's at some stage he will be involved in an inauguration of the Mishkan or the Beis HaMikdash. And that, of course, is a reference to the inauguration or the dedication, rededication of the Beis HaMikdash in the Hanukkah story, which was done al yedei kohanecha hakadoshim. The consolation that is given to Aaron being excluded from a Hanukkah is Hanukkah later on. And that, says Ramban, is greater than what the Nesi'im did. And how is it greater? That we have to see. It seems like they had their inauguration, the Kohanim have their inauguration. How is it greater? But Ramban supports his idea that the consolation for Aaron is the Chanukah inauguration in the Chanukah story by the Chashmonaim. He cites a Medrash Tanchuma. The Medrash Tanchuma says, or gives us a different piece of what is said to Aaron here. Hashem says to Aaron, the korbanos, such as were brought by the Nesi'im on those 12 days, they exist as long as the Beis HaMikdash exists. But if the Beis HaMikdash would cease, they would cease. Aval haneros la'olam heim dolkim. The haneros la'olam ya'iru. The lights of the menorah will always shine, will always be lit. So says the Medrash Tanchuma. That's the consolation to Aaron. Asks the Ramban, if the consolation for Aaron came in the form of his lighting the menorah in the Beis HaMikdash as part of the regular service, why does the Medrash Tanchuma say that the other korbanos may stop, but this will continue? As surely as the other korbanos stops with the cessation of the Beis HaMikdash, so does the lighting of the menorah in the Beis HaMikdash. Why would the Tanchuma say that it endures? Unless, says Ramban, what it means to say is, as we are explaining, that the reference is to the mitzvah of Hanukkah, which is then celebrated every year and commemorated, even in the absence of the Beis HaMikdash, until it returns, the korbanos cease, the menorah continues to burn on Hanukkah. This is the support of Ramban for his understanding that the consolation for Aaron was the Hanukkah in the time of the second Beis HaMikdash through the Hashmonaim, who were Kohanim. I saw, though, that a number of Mefarshim raise a simple question on the Ramban. Namely, once we open up the idea that the consolation for Aaron is the Hanukkah story, and the menorah in question is the menorah of Hanukkah, why would Hashem say, Shelcha gedola mishelahem? Your tribe felt left out, but you will have something that they don't have. Your portion will be greater than their portion, because you have the menorah. Say the Mefarshim, everyone has the menorah. The menorah is everyone's portion. If Aaron felt excluded because they were doing something that he wasn't doing, and Hashem says, yeah, but you'll do something that's greater than them, that implies that they're not doing it. But the Hanukkah lights that endure are lit by everyone. You don't have to be a Kohen or a Levi to light the menorah on Hanukkah. So everyone has it. So how then is this the great consolation for Aaron? This is special for you. Hanukkah's for everyone. This is a question that some Mefarshim ask. And I wonder whether, in a case such as this, we might respond by saying that the question is the answer. As if to say, they have their Hanukkah, which is their korbanos, and you have a Hanukkah which will be greater than theirs. In what way is it greater? It's greater in the fact that it then becomes the province of the entire Jewish people. That's its greatness. And its greatness is ascribed to the Kohanim. As if to say, what is the greatest merit that a certain group could have? That they are the cause and the catalyst for merit nationwide. What greater merit is there than that? For what is merit if not increasing mitzvos? And here, where in addition to what they may have done, they then are the trigger for the entire Jewish people on an ongoing basis, there is no greater merit for the Kohanim than being the cause for the menorah being lit by the entire Jewish people. That's its greatness. So what was posed as a difficulty for the Ramban's approach, this isn't special for Aaron, everyone does it. That's what makes it special for Aaron, that everyone does it because of what the Kohanim did. They will always remain the cause of the mitzvah of Hanukkah lights, and we always mention them. And what this means, aside from anything else, is that if they are the cause, and it's fascinating to consider it in this way, if they are the cause of the entire Jewish people lighting the menorah on a yearly basis, then they have a share in that merit as well. If one person leads another person to merit, so then the first person has a share in all the merits as a partner in that. The pasuk says in Yirmiyahu, it's a pasuk that we read occasionally, Gadol ha'etza v'rav ha'alilya. Hashem says to the prophet Yirmiyahu says to Hashem that great counsel, great wisdom. Asher inecha pekuchos odarcha b'nei adam. Your ways, your eyes, are supervising the ways of people. Laseis leish kidrachav v'kiprima alalav. To give each person kidrachav in accordance with their ways, v'kiprima alalav, and according to the fruits of their deeds. Rabbi Yeshua Heller, in his Perush Toldos Yehoshua on Pirkei Avos, asks, what is the difference between these two concluding expressions? Kidrachav, in accordance with his ways, and Kifrim Alalav, the fruits of his deeds. Are the fruits of his actions not the same as his ways? Your ways are made up of your actions. It's the same thing. Says Rabbi Shua Heller, it's not the same thing. Kidrachav, a person's ways, a person is judged for their ways in the sense of their deeds, their own deeds. A person's ways comprise the deeds that they do. That's one element of what a person is judged for, judged concerning. But there's a second element which extends beyond the person. Prima alalav, the fruits of their actions, not the action themselves, but what it leads to. As a partner in that, they have a share in it. For good, hopefully, and hopefully not for the opposite. If a person brings someone else closer to mitzvah observance, they have a share in every single mitzvah that that person does. And not only that person, anyone else who's influenced and inspired by that person. In the grand reckoning, there will always be a share. And with this in mind, Rabbi Shua Heller explains the expression, the mode of expression, in the Gemara in Maseches Rosh Hashanah and in Erechin, in explaining why we don't say Hallel on Rosh Hashanah or on Yom Kippur, even though they're Yomim Tovim, and in its own way, Yom Kippur is a day of Simcha. The Mishnah says Yom Kippur is one of the happiest days. Yes, but not in that way. It has such a serious element to it. Just like Rosh Hashanah. Why? Says the Gemara, because the Hamelech Yoshev al Kisei Din, the king is sitting on the throne of judgment, V'sifrei Chayim V'sifrei Mesim Pesuchim Lefanov. The books of the living and the books of the dead are open before him. That is not, we're optimistic, but that's not a time for saying Hallel. Wait till Sukkos. But the Gemara described the din as the books of the living and the books of the dead are open before Hashem. Asks Rabbi Shua Heller, the books of the living need to be open because they are a going concern. They have done things in whatever direction it may be over the last year that need to be judged. But why would the books of the dead need to be open every year? And one may say that the books of the living and the books of the dead mean who should, as a result of this year, end up in which book. But Rabbi Shua Heller says, no, the books of those who have departed are reopened every year. Because their deeds are no longer, but the fruits of their actions endure and continue and have continued to reap dividends for them in so many different ways that are incalculable to anyone except for HaKadosh Baruch Hu over the past year, regardless of how long they haven't been in the world. Because they set things in motion, and they will always be part of the things that are even in some measure inspired and influenced by them. And therefore, coming back to the question on Ramban, what would we say? The Chashmonaim will have the opportunity, will have the merit to bring about an inauguration that will then become a mitzvah which is performed by the entire Jewish people. What greater merit for the Chashmonaim than that? Shelcha gedola mishelahem. And indeed, this is an idea which finds expression in last week's Parsha as well, specifically in the section of the Nesi'im, which is that very long section. It's always 90 psukim. We know it from Chanukah, and we certainly know it from Parshas Noso. And there's a certain rhythm to the psukim, because effectively the same thing is said over 12 times. But on the second day, we find something of a departure. Day one, the Nasi who brought the Korban on the first day is the Nasi of Yehuda, Nachshon ben Aminadav. For obvious reasons, Yehuda already has the mantle of Malchus, his tribe goes first. But who brings on the second day? The Nasi of Yisachar. Bayom HaShini, Nasi Livnei Yisachar, Nisanel ben su'ar. And just to get the pasuk, it's in Perek Zion. Pasuk Yudches. Bayom Hasheni, Hikriv Nesanel ben su'ar, Nesi Yisachar. Okay, Yisachar is second. Hikriv es korbano, karas kesef achash, lo shima meyam mishkala, etc., etc., as we know, the component parts of each nasi. Why is Yisachar second? Rashi comments, I mean, he's not second in, not by birth and not by, so, as soon as pride of place has been given to Yehuda, why does Yisachar mention next, effectively, the first one by merit? Says Rashi, because actually, the idea of the Chanukah was Nesanel ben Suar's idea. It came from the Nasi of Yisachar. Yisachar, we know from other sources, have their own expertise in Torah, and Yisachar was the one who behind the idea of the Nesim bringing korbanos. And therefore, as soon as Yehuda has been given day one, day two is for the Nasi of Yisachar. Very interesting. But the matter goes further. Because not only is Yisachar second, the phraseology for his korban is a little different than the others. Because back to Pasuk Yudches, Bayom HaSheni, Hikriv Nesanel ben Suar Nasi Yisachar, the next pasuk we know from the following 10 cases. Korbano karas kesef achas. Korbano karas kesef achas. His korban was such and such and such. But here it says, hikrivis korbano karas kesef achas. That's an interesting departure. It doesn't say that with the others. It just says korbano. Moreover, the reference to this Nasi bringing the korban is already in the first verse. Pasuk Yudches, Bayom HaSheni, Hikriv Nesanel Ben Suar. That's also a departure. In the others it says, Bayom HaSheni, Nasi Levnei, so-and-so, so-and-so. It doesn't use the verb Hikriv, not in the first Pasuk, not in the second Pasuk. And here it mentions it twice. Halo Davarhu. The first Pasuk, Yudches says, Bayom HaSheni, Hikriv Nesanel Ben Suar. And then goes on to say, Hikriv es korbano, says the Ksav Sofer. What does this tell us? It tells us, you know why this Nasi of Yisachar is referred to as bringing a korban twice? Because there are two capacities in which he is accredited with bringing a korban. Number one, his own. But number two, Hikriv es korbano. He brought his korban, meaning he brought the korban of every other person. Because it was his idea. He inspired them to do it. So the first verse is, on the second day he brought his own personal korbanos. But be aware, Hikriv es korbano. It's a complete, it's in terms of the pasuk that Rabbi Shuhela quoted, the one pasuk is drachav, what he himself did, and the other is kipri ma'alalav. So it's very interesting to see the idea that leads out from Aaron's future Chanukah, which mushrooms out from the Kohanim to the entire Jewish people, and is a great schus therefore for the Kohanim, already can be seen in internal form within the Nasiim themselves, the relationship of the Nasi of Yisachar to all the others. So, as we are seeing, we don't have to get too far into Parshas Baalosecha to already see how the discussions unfold. And these are the classic approaches of Rashi and Ramban with additional comments. Much food for thought, I believe. Let us move on in Baalosecha to the beginning of Perek Tes, which is the Parsha of Pesach Sheni, as we know it. But it begins with Pesach Rishon, and in fact, I would like to comment on one letter in Perek Tes, and let us get there. So Perek Tes, Pasuk Aleph is time and place. And then Pasuk Beis. Perek Tes, Pasuk Beis. V'yasu v'nei Yisrael es ha-posach b'moado. B'nei Yisrael, they will bring the Pesach in its time. It's very rare that the word Pesach is called Pasach in the middle of a Pasuk. But this really accentuates the roll under the pay of Pasach is a term called the tipcha, which conveniently, lahavdil, is like a comma. The strongest pause in the middle of a pasuk will change the pronunciation to a komatz. As we know, Eretz becomes Aretz, and Kena'an becomes Kena'an, and so on. It's almost never a tipcha. The tipcha is the mildest of all the pauses. It will normally be something like the esnachtar, the big esnachtar, or the zakev katan. But this is such a short pasuk, the tipcha, for once, is the strongest pause in the pasuk. And that's why it finally has its day, and Pesach becomes Pasach in the middle of a pasuk. Either way, coming back to the beginning of this pasuk, V'yasu v'nei Yisrael es ha-Pasach. What is noteworthy about this pasuk? It's simply commanding them to bring the Korban Pesach. But there is something noteworthy about it. The vav at the beginning, V'yasu. Why is that noteworthy? Because generally speaking, when a command is given, it uses what's called the vav ha-hipuch. That is to say, it takes the past tense and flips it into the future. The vav flips it into the future. For example, ve'asu lehem tzitzis. Asu is the past tense. Ve'asu, the vav, flips it into the future. Vav ha-hipuch, the vav conversive. Okay, and that is standard. The Ya'asu is already in the future. They will. Which means the Vav is not needed to flip it into the future. It's already a future tense. So the Vav just means and. Why would you start a command with and? When the Vav is used as a Vav ha-hipuch, according to many, I don't know if this is the consensus or everyone, but according to many Balei Haloshon, it's not to be translated as and. The vav there isn't functioning as a vav achibor, vav conjunctive, to say and. It's just there as a means to which to change the tense of from past to future. So va'asu really is not translated as and they shall make tzitzis. Va'asu lehem tzitzis is they shall make tzitzis. The vav doesn't mean and. And you shouldn't start a sentence with and anyway. But we do here, for the reason that we said. Ya'asu is already in the future, and Vav just means and. Why would you start the mitzvah with and? This question is addressed by Rabbi Yosef Salant in the Be'er Yosef. And he explains that if you want to understand why the Korban Pesach, Vav, that means and, connects it to what was mentioned earlier. But what was discussed earlier? The mitzvah of Levim. Meaning, the Kedusha, sorry, the Avoda, the province of service in the Mishkan, has been transferred, removed from the Bechor, which used to have it, and now it's given to the Levim. That is described at quite some length in Perek Ches. It's effectively the section between the menorah and here. So there's most of Perek Ches is a description of how the Avoda is taken from the Bechorim and given to the Levim. So, well, what is Korban Pesach about? Korban Pesach is celebrating and remembering that at Makas Bechoros, when Hashem skipped over the houses of the Jews and smote only the firstborn of the Egyptians, the result of that was that the Bechorim became sanctified. And that then translates into the Korban. That's what Korban Pesach is about. It's about this very specific part of Yetzias Mitzrayim. But this part, the Kedusha of the Bechorim, seemingly is just becoming undone now. Because the Avodah is being taken from them. Their status is being divested from them. And is being transferred to the Levim. Which raises us a very interesting question. Should we still bring a Korban Pesach? If Pesach is about what happened to the Bechorim, but what happened to the Bechorim has just unhappened, So, of course, the festival of Pesach is still there because that's about Yetzias Mitzrayim. We've still left. But the specific element of the Bechorim and what happened with them, that's seemingly been reversed. One may have even thought that there's no Korban Pesach anymore. You just have Pesach without a Korban Pesach. It's still a Yom Tov, and you can bring other Korbanos. But the whole background to the Korban Pesach has been undone. To that end, says the Torah, correct, the Bechorim have lost their Avodah, the Ya'asu, and yet still bring the Korban Pesach. As much as in our understanding or in our conception, the Bechorim have lost their Kedusha, nevertheless, the mitzvah of Korban Pesach exists independently of that, but this is certainly apropos of that discussion. You understand why it's connected with the Vav. That even though the Bechorim have lost that status, nevertheless, v'yasu, and yet, the Jewish people should bring the Korban Pesach. But this actually leads us to a very interesting question. Or perhaps even more than one question. When it comes to the situation with the firstborn, and then with the Egel, they fell from grace, and then the Levim are now taking over, so the Bechorim don't have their original status anymore. We need to ask a couple of basic questions. Firstly, the implication seems to be that the Bechorim originally were the ones who did the Avodah. And where do they get that status from? From having been sanctified at Makas Bechorus. So what happened before Makas Bechorus? If a person would ever bring a Korban before Makas Bechorus, and there was a choice of who should bring it, who would bring it? The Bechorim seemingly had not yet come into play as the person of choice. That all starts with Makas Bechorus, the night before we leave Mitzrayim. But what about in the times of the Avos? Or anywhere? Was there no notion? Was there no preference at all for anyone? And parenthetically, we add, we know from Rashi, for example, that's not the case. Because Yaakov wanted to take the Bechorah from Esav, because he felt Esav, as Bechor, was not eligible to do the Avodah, and therefore Yaakov wanted to have that transferred to him. How that transfer works is a question for Parshas Toldos. If Bechor means the firstborn, you can't purchase an event of having been firstborn. But however it works, that's something we've discussed in Toldos, but what we do see is the notion is already very clearly there that all things being equal, the default is it's the Bechor who does the Avodah. But why? By virtue of what? What made that happen? Certainly not Makas Bechoros. This is years before Makas Bechoros. But if the notion that the Bechor does the Avodah preceded Makas Bechoros, then what difference did Makas Bechoros make? Additionally, we see that the Kedusha of the Bechor is being transferred onto the Levi. As a result of what? The Chet HaEgel. Implying that were it not for the Chet HaEgel, the Bechorim would just stay where they were and there would be no transfer or redemption of their status. It's just because of the Egel this idea came into play. The problem is, the idea of redeeming a firstborn is mentioned in the Torah before the Chet HaEgel. It's mentioned in the Torah the day on which we left Mitzrayim. It's the end of Parshas Bo. Shmos Perek Yud Gimel, in the sections of Kaddish and Havaya Keviacha, some people say this every day, with the Tefillin. When your son will say to you, Mazos, and you start to tell him, you say, Vayihi Kik Shofar Ulish Achenu, Vayaroga Shem Kol Bechor Be'eretz Mitzrayim, this is Shmos Perek Yud Gimel, Pasuk Tes Vav, it's the penultimate Pasuk of Parshas Bo. Hashem smote the Bechor, mi Bechor Adam, at Bechor Behema, al kein ani zoveach l'Hashem kol peter rechem azachorim. Therefore, I offer as a korban the firstborn of my animals, v'chol Bechor banai efteh, and I redeem my firstborn. So the idea of redeeming the firstborn is there from day one, from the day that we left Mitzrayim. But why we're then coming to see it in our parsha, this concept of transfer of Kedusha from the Bechor to the Levi, as a result of the Chet HaEgel. And moreover, as we know, ever since this transfer took place from the Bechorim to the Leviim, we still do Pidyon Abin. So apparently it didn't make a difference. The Leviim retained their rights. But you still do Pidyon Bechor, Pidyon Abin. All of this requires further inspection. And there is no doubt more than one way to look at it, but a fascinating picture of the whole situation here is to be found in the writings of the Sephorno. Now, the Sephorno discusses it here, but more at length in where this is first mentioned in Bamidbar, which is in Perek Gimel. So the transfer of Kedusha from the firstborn to the Levim is actually discussed twice in the beginning of Bamidbar. First in Parshas Bamidbar, Perek Gimel, and then in our Parsha in Perek Ches. But it all begins in Perek Gimel, and through his words there, which is where he really sets up camp in this matter, that's where we will see, and it is very thought-provoking and stimulating. A lot of pieces moving here, as we'll see. So Perek Gimel, Pasuk Yud Gimel. So let us read the Pasuk again. It's Perek Bamidbar Perek Gimel Pasuk Yud Gimel. Kili chol bechor, for every bechor is mine. So we should preface with Pasuk Yud Beis, where Hashem says, "Va'ani hinei lakachti es ha-leviim mitoch b'nei Yisrael." I've taken down the Leviim instead of b'nei Yisrael. Tachas kol bechor peter rechem b'nei Yisrael. Specifically, the Leviim are instead of every firstborn. Va'yuli ha-leviim. The Leviim will be mine. So that's Pasuk Yud Beis, is the transfer from Bechor to the Leviim. And then Hashem elaborates, Kili kol Bechor, every Bechor is mine. B'yom ha-kosi kol Bechor be'eretz Mitzrayim, hikdashti li kol Bechor be'Yisrael. On the day that I smote the firstborn of Mitzrayim, I sanctified the Bechorim. Me'od bad behema, li yihyu ani Hashem. They shall be mine. What is this coming to explain? And what is happening now? And how does it fit in with what happened before? The key, says the Sforno, is that there are two separate elements to the Kedusha of Bechor, and each one needs to be tracked. They are almost independent of each other. The first element of the Kedusha of the Bechor is that the Avodah naturally accrues to the Bechor. He has that preferred status. And that's aspect number one. That has nothing to do with Makas Bechoros. It was always there even before Makas Bechoros. That's number one. Number two, with Makas Bechoros, an additional element of Kedusha came to the Bechorim, to the firstborn. This is not about doing the Avodah. It's something else entirely, and it is absolutely fascinating. Says the Sforno, the reason why Hashem sanctified, and let us follow it in Pasuk Yud Gimel, reading carefully so that we don't get ahead of ourselves and see, Pasuk Yud Gimel, ki li kol Bechor, every Bechor is mine, says the Sforno, that's with reference to doing the Avodah. And that, in principle, should always remain that way. But then we move on to the next thing. B'yom ha-kosi kol b'chor be'eretz Mitzrayim. On the day that I smote the firstborn of Mitzrayim, hikdashti li kol b'chor b'Yisrael. I sanctified the b'chorin for me. What is the nature of what is effectively the second level of sanctification? Even before Makas Bechoros, the Bechor has Kedusha of sorts. Why are you giving him more Kedusha? What is that doing? What it's doing, says the Sforno, is it is protecting the Jewish firstborn by being Mekadosh them. How so? Says the Sforno, Makkas Bechoros, this nationwide plague, was a plague. And as Chazal describe, at a time when there's a plague, certain people are more at risk, spiritually. The more prominent a person is, perhaps the more would be demanded of them. The Bechorim were the prominent ones among the Jewish people. But ironically, that actually put them at risk. Because as such, they're more susceptible to being swept in with a plague. And in effect, therefore, they need to be removed. He cites what the angel said to Lot at the time of Sodom. You've got to get out, otherwise you'll be swept up with the plague. Penti sofer ba'avon ha'ir. Lot was not enough of a tzaddik to be saved if he would stay where he was, and neither were the Bechorim. So they're in this intermediate situation. They're prominent, but that only puts them more at risk. But they're not tzaddikim enough that they could be saved without being removed from the reach of the plague. How do you remove them? Says the Sforno, by making them hektish, by sanctifying them. How does that remove them? Because what does it mean to make something hektish? It brings it into Hashem's domain. And conceptually, therefore, they no longer exist within the domain of the Egyptians. And as such, they're not there. For Lot, the situation was much more dire. He physically needs to leave in order to be spared getting swept up. For the Bechorim, they conceptually leave. How do they leave Mitzrayim? And where do they go? Hashem says, I'll bring them into my realm. That's called Hekdash. Hekdashti li kol Bechor. The first ones to leave Mitzrayim were the Bechorim, but they didn't go out into the desert. They went into Hashem's domain. Now that was done for their protection. However, we know there are certain parameters that apply to something that's hektish. You can't use it for normal purposes. Which means having been put into Hashem's domain, sanctified to Hashem's domain for their protection, but once the plague is over, they need to return to the world. They need to return to the temporal domain. Otherwise, they can't be involved in mundane activities. And that's why they need to be redeemed. When danger is past, like any hektish, they're redeemed back. And that's Pidyon HaBen. That has nothing to do with do they do the avoda or not. They did the avoda even before this whole thing happened. The Bechorim always did the avoda, and they'll do it afterwards, unless something goes terribly wrong, which it did with the Chet HaEgel. But it's the idea of sanctifying them into Hashem's realm and then bringing them back again is for purposes of just allowing them to get back into the world. But they come back into the world as the preferred choice for the one who does the avoda. The only thing that stopped them doing the avoda was having fallen at the time of the Chet HaEgel, where they were involved in the Egel. At that point, they are no longer the person of choice to do the avoda. That's transferred to the Levim. It's a one-off transfer. It never goes back. But what will remain true for all generations is that every Bechor that's born needs to be redeemed because he still has a vestige of the Hektish Bechor status that was given to the Bechorim originally. But that has nothing to do with the Avoda anymore. So the more we look at it, the more we see that these two elements, again, to summarize, because there aren't a number of pieces here, but the two elements of the status of the Bechor, number one, doing the Avoda, and number two, being in Hashem's domain for purposes of protection, those are two separate things, and they have two completely different destinies. And one of them was lost, namely doing the Avoda, but the other remains for every Bechor ever since. And that is why, and when you think about it, to look again at that Pasuk, Perek Gimel, Pasuk Yud Beis, Pasuk Yud Beis says, I've taken the Levim instead of the Bechorim. So on a simple level, in our monolithic view where it's all just one thing. So the Bechorim are no longer a going concern. They're no longer have that sanctified status. But then the next pasuk says, every Bechor is mine. And concludes by saying, Li Yihiyu Ani Hashem, the Bechorim will remain mine. How can you, in the pasuk Yud Beis, say, I've transferred Kedusha from them to the Levim, and then conclude the next pasuk by saying, they will remain mine? Says the Sforno, because the element that was transferred for them is different than the element that Hashem retains as his. The element that was transferred from them is doing the Avoda, that they lost. But Li Yihiyu, they remain mine in terms of having brought them into my domain. Ani Hashem, that's how the pasuk concludes, says the Sforno, Ani Hashem lo shanisi. I am Hashem, I haven't changed. My relationship with them hasn't changed. Their relationship with me changed. Their eligibility to do the avoda, they forfeited that. But my bringing them into my domain, which requires pidyon, that remains true, and it remains true until our time. So this is the compelling analysis of the Sforno. And just to conclude, just to bring it back to in terms of where we are, Perek Tes, which starts with the letter Vav, V'ya'asu v'nei Yisrael, for the Sforno will be very different. The and that links the transfer of Avoda from Bechorim to Levim with the Korban Pesach, the Vav in the middle links them. It's the opposite of the Be'er Yosef, because what Hashem is saying is, I am transferring Avoda from the Bechor to the Levim, but that has nothing to do with the Korban Pesach, because the Korban Pesach is about the element that hasn't changed about the Bechorim, and therefore they should proceed. The Kedusha that accrued to them to protect them remains true even after they lost the Avoda, and therefore Korban Pesach should proceed. Not in spite of what's just happened, but regardless of what's just happened, it's a different aspect of the Kedusha of the Levi. So this is the Parshanut of the Sforno, and we see how these major, major questions, even historically, and to understand halachically, and thematically, and experientially, about the Bechorim and the Levim, how it touches on these big questions, in the end it comes down to the letter Vav, as one parsha is linked to the other, as we so often see, Mihaklal El Haprat. The final section that I wanted to take a look at, again, we've missed out almost everything, it means Hashem leave more for other times. But this section at the end of the parsha, which is Aaron and Miriam talking about Moshe. And briefly, and we'll take Rashi's approach, there are other approaches also, we will need to take a look at that at a different time. But in Perek Yud Beis, they say, at the beginning, Yud Beis Pasuk Aleph, Vatidaber, Miriam the Aaron B'Moshe, they spoke about Moshe, Alodosa Isha, Kushis HaShelokach, she's called an Isha Kushis. Rashi says that this is Tzipora. And the point is that Moshe had separated from Tzipora. Again, there's other views among Rishonim. But for our purposes, what do they say? Pasuk Beis. Vayomu, Harak Ach B'Moshe Diber Hashem. They understood that Moshe separated from his wife because he needs to receive nevuah from Hashem. Says Aaron and Miriam, does Hashem only speak to Moshe? Hello, Gambonu Diber. He speaks to us also. We didn't separate from our spouses. That's their Lashon Hara. So everything is context. The thing that they said about Moshe is that they did not realize, seemingly, that his level of nevuah required that he separate from his spouse, as the Gemara describes, separate from his wife. And they didn't realize that his level of nevuah was greater than theirs. And so they spoke, and that's what they said. That was their Lashon Hara in that context and on their level. Now the pasuk says, "Vo'ish Moshe anav ma'od mikol ha'adam asher p'ni adam." Moshe was the most humble person anywhere on the face of the earth. Why is the pasuk saying this? What is this? How does it? And if he wasn't humble, it wouldn't be Lashon Hara. I mean, We know this to be so, but why is it mentioned here? It's a question very easy not to ask. But Ibn Ezra asks this question. And let's say the pasuk wasn't here. Everything else is still the same. It's not correct what they're saying. The Ibn Ezra explains that the reason why the pasuk says Vayish Moshe Anav Ma'od is because really what Aaron and Miriam were saying is that Moshe wrongfully separated from his wife. He didn't need to, but maybe he not for prophecy purposes, because we get prophecy and we're still with our spouses. So if he didn't separate for prophecy purposes, it must have been for other purposes. Maybe he thought that she wasn't good enough for him anymore or something like that. To that, the pasuk says no. Moshe would never think that. Vayish Moshe Anav Ma'od. Moshe is a humble person. He would never look at his spouse and say, "Oh, she's beneath me." So it comes apropos as the Torah refuting the basis of what Aaron and Miriam were saying. A very different interpretation actually is given by Rav Hirsch. And again, if our question is, why does the Torah mention here that Moshe is the most humble person? What's it got to do with what they're saying about him? Says Rav Hirsch, as we mentioned just a moment ago, what they're saying is, receiving prophecy doesn't mean you have to separate from your spouse. Look at us. We're prophets, and we're still with our spouses. So Moshe should be no different. In other words, they thought that Moshe was no different. They didn't realize that his nevuah is a categorically different level than theirs. If they did know that, then they would have realized. But they didn't know that. But Moshe knows it. I mean, Moshe experiences it. He knows what a normal nevuah is like, and he knows that he is on a different level than that. But he never told them. Clearly. Why not? Says our first, because Ish Moshe, Anav Ma'od. Why does it need to be said? No, it's not. He receives his nevuah. He does what needs to be done. His nevuah happens to be on a level that is unique to any human being ever in the history of the world, but there's no need to talk about it. Because Anava is staying focused on the ideal and not a person promoting themselves. That's what Anava is. And therefore, for purposes of Moshe transmitting the Torah, he has received or attained a unique level of prophecy. But it's not a conversation point as far as Moshe is concerned. And we add parenthetically, not even to Aaron and Miriam. But what is that? Says our verse, that's Anava. Anava doesn't mean you don't do what needs to be done and you don't use your capabilities to the full. But you don't need to talk about them if it's not relevant. And of course, whenever we see we read this pasuk, which says that Moshe was the most humble person in the face of the earth, the first person, the first human being ever to hear this pasuk was Moshe. I mean, he was instructed to transcribe it in the Torah. And one has to picture Moshe writing on Hashem's instructions and authority. Moshe is the most humble person on the face of the earth, and according to some, in the history of the world, ever. And amazingly, it was still true by the time he finished writing it. Because even a person knowing that they're humble is not a contradiction to humility. Humility is not about a person not knowing their capabilities and strong points and talents and strengths. It's always about the question, what is the goal? What is being promoted here? The ideal, the cause, or the person himself? As long as it's the ideal, the more a person knows about their strengths and greatness, the better, the more effective they'll be, and the more idealistic they'll be. That's the yisod that's being communicated here. There is, and we'll conclude, with a very interesting comment of the Medrash. The word Anav, if you look, there's a kriyuk siv. This is in Pasuk Gimel. Vayish Moshe Anav Ma'od. Moshe is most Anav. So the word Anav, which should be written as Ayin Nun Yudvav, is actually written without the yud. It's written chaser. And again, we might be tempted to say, well, you know, what more appropriate word to be written chaser than the word anav? But once we remember that the anav is not about deficiency, but it's about maintaining perspective on what the ideal is, so it deserves comment, and the Medrash does comment But what the Medrash says is itself quite striking. The Medrash says the reason why there's a letter Yud written missing from the word Anav is because it's actually coming to undo the message. There was one person who was more Anav than Moshe. And that's Shmuel, the Navi Shmuel. Why does the Medrash say this, and how do we see this? Because, says the Medrash, consider, when there's a message for the people, who goes to whom? Does the prophet go to the people? The people come to the prophet. With Moshe, we see that the people always come to him. But when it comes to Shmuel, when he would judge the people, he would travel around and he would go to them. The Pasuk says he would come back once a year. Uchuvoso haramoso, kishon beso. He was on the road for most of the year. Why should the people come to me? I can go to them. So you see, says the Medrash, that Shmuel is more humble than Moshe. Asks Rabbi Yehuda Asad. Mazos asah ha-medrash lanu. I mean, what is the Medrash doing and how can it say this? The Pasuk says that Moshe is the most humble person. And the Medrash says, well, there's a Yud missing because there was someone who was more. So if there's someone who was more, then Moshe wasn't. But the Pasuk says that he was. Taking a Yud away doesn't change that. But that's why Rabbi Yehuda Mari Asad says that the truth is Moshe, in pure terms, as the Pasuk says, was the most humble person. But he wasn't always able to act that way. Because Moshe was a king. Vayi bishurin melech. Moshe had the status of melech. A rav can be mochel on his kovod. Rav shemochel al kvodo, kvodo mochel. But melech shemochel al kvodo, en kvodo mochel. The king doesn't have the right to be mochel on his kovod. Some say because his kovod, Tosfos say, Nevodazaris, because its covet is the covet of the Jewish people. So Moshe, in pure terms, as the Torah says, is the most humble person. But there's certain trappings of office that trap him. He's restricted by the office of being melech that he cannot go to the people. And Shmuel can. And thus in practice, so to speak, Shmuel was more of an anav. But when the Pasuk says that Moshe was an anav, it means if only he could. And could he? Was there ever a time that he could? Towards the end of Chumash Devarim, you have Parshas Vayelech, which starts, Vayelech Moshe, Vayidaber Kol Ha'am. Moshe goes and he speaks to the people. That's interesting. Here we have Moshe going to the people. But is he not a king? Says the Vilna Gaon, no. The Pasuk says, this is the final day of his life. In Me'aves Shem Shana Anuchi Hayom, he knew this was the final day of his life. The Pasuk says in Koheles, Ein Shilton B'yom Hamaves. There is no sovereignty on the day of death. On that final day of his life, and in fact the mantle had already been given over to Yoshua, Moshe's not a king. He's not a king. Off he goes. He has a message to the people. He goes to them. Just like he always wanted to. That's really what's so amazing about this. For 40 years, the people have been coming to Moshe. It's the type of thing one can imagine you could get used to. And certainly on the last day of his life, one would certainly not, no one would have begrudged him a bonus day, just a day where he's not the king, but everyone would have come to him. And what do we see? He never got used to it. He always had to repress an urge. Why should I come to the people? Why should the people come to me? I should go to them. I'm the king. Okay, what can I do? And the last day of his life, I'm not the king anymore. So as I would have always wanted to do, this is his final message, let him go to the people. And that's the anava finally able to express itself in practice that the Pasuk was talking about from the outset. So certainly much to think about in terms of the beginning of the parsha, the middle and towards the end, not to forget over the course of Shabbos to fill in everything in between. But in the meanwhile, we'll leave it over here. Meet again in Mitzvah Hashem next week. We should have a good week, a good evening. Shabbos Tovos and Yeshua's Bekarov. All the very best.